occur in the home. Is that not so, Mr. Vandemar?
I don't trust statistics, said Mr. Vandemar's blank voice. A gloved hand reached down from behind Varney, crushed his sword, and dropped the twisted thing to the floor.
How are you, Varney? Asked Mr. Croup. Well, we trust, yes, in fine form, fetlock and fettle for the market tonight. Do you know who we are?
Varney did the nearest thing he could to a nod that didn't actually involve moving any muscles. He knew who Croup and Vandemar were. His eyes were searching the walls. Yes, there, the Morning Star, a spiked wooden ball studded with nails on a chain in the far corner of the room.
There is talk that a certain young lady will be auditioning bodyguards this evening. Had you thought of trying out for the task?
Mr. Croup picked at his tombstone teeth.
Enunciate clearly.
Varney picked up the Morning Star with his mind. It was his knack. Gentle now, slowly. He edged it off the hook and pulled it up toward the top of the tunnel arch. With his mouth, he said,
Varney's the best bravo and guard in the underside. They say I'm the best since Hunter's Day.
Varney mentally positioned the Morning Star in the shadows above and behind Mr. Croup's head. He would crush Croup's skull first, then he'd take Vandemar. The Morning Star plunged towards Mr. Croup's head. Varney flung himself down away from the knife blade at his eye. Mr. Croup did not look up. He did not turn. He simply moved his head obscenely fast, and the Morning Star crashed past him into the floor where it threw up chips of brick and concrete. Mr. Vandemar picked Varney up with one hand.
Hurt him? He asked his partner.
Mr. Croup shook his head. Not yet. And to Varney, he said,
Not bad. So, best bravo and guard, we want you to get yourself to the market tonight. We want you to do whatever you have to become that certain young lady's personal bodyguard. Then when you get the job, one thing you don't forget. You may guard her from the rest of the world, but when we want her, we take her. Got it?
Varney ran his tongue over the wreck of his teeth.
Are you bribing me? He asked.
Mr. Vandemar had picked up the Morning Star. He was pulling the chain apart with his free hand, link by link, and dropping the bits of twisted metal onto the floor. Chink.
No, said Mr. Vandemar.
Chink.
We're intimidating you.
Chink.
And if you don't do what Mr. Croup says, we're...
Chink.
Hurting you.
Chink.
Very badly before we're...
Chink.
Killing you. Even badlier.
Ah, said Varney. Then I'm working for you, aren't I? Yes, you are, said Mr. Croup. I'm afraid we don't have any redeeming features.
That doesn't bother me, said Varney.
Good, said Mr. Croup. Welcome aboard.
It was a large but elegant mechanism, built of polished walnut and oak, of brass and glass, copper and mirrors, and carved and inlaid ivory, of quartz prisms and brass gears and springs and cogs. The whole thing was rather larger than a widescreen television, although the actual screen itself was no more than 6 inches across. A magnifying lens placed across it increased the size of the picture. There was a large brass horn, like an ear trumpet, coming out of the side, the kind you could find on an antique gramophone. The whole mechanism looked rather like a combined television and video player might look, if it had been invented and built 300 years ago by Sir Isaac Newton, which was, more or less, exactly what it was. Watch, said Dor. She placed the wooden ball onto a platform. Lights shone through the machine and into the ball. It began to spin around and around. A patrician face appeared on the small screen, vividly coloured. Slightly out of time, a voice came from the horn, crackling in mid-speech.
That two cities should be so near, said the voice. And yet in all things so far, the possessors above us, and the dispossessed, we who live below and between, who live in the cracks.
Dor stared at the screen, her face unreadable.
Still,
said her father,
I am of the opinion that what cripples us, who inhabit the underside, is our petty factionalism. The system of baronies and fiefdoms is both divisive and foolish.
The Lord Portico was wearing a threadbare old smoking jacket and a skull cap. His voice seemed to be coming to them across the centuries, not days or weeks. He coughed.
I am not alone in this belief. There are those who wish to see things the way they are. There are others who wish the situation to worsen. There are those...
Can you speed it up? Asked the Marquis. Find the last entry. Dor nodded. She touched an ivory lever at the side. The image ghosted, fragmented, reformed. Now Portico wore a long coat. His skull cap was gone. There was a scarlet gash down one side of his head. He was no longer sitting at his desk. He was talking urgently, quietly.
I do not know who will see this, who will find this, but whoever you are, please take this to my daughter, the Lady Dor, if she lives.
A static burst wiped across the picture and the sound. Then,
Dor... Girl, this is bad. I don't know how long I've got before they find this room. I think my poor Portia and your brother and sister are dead.
The sound and picture quality began to degrade. The Marquis glanced at Dor. Her face was wet. Tears were brimming from her eyes, glistening down her cheeks. She seemed unaware that she was crying, made no attempt to wipe away the tears. She just stared at her father's image. Listen to his words. Crackle. Wipe. Crackle.
Listen to me, girl,
said her dead father.
Go to Islington. You can trust Islington. You must believe in Islington.
He ghosted. Blood had dripped from his forehead into his eyes, and he wiped it off.
Dor, avenge us. Avenge your family.
A loud bang came from the gramophone horn. Portico turned his head to look off screen, puzzled and nervous. What? He said, and he stepped out of frame. For a moment, the picture remained unchanged, the desk, the blank wall behind it. Then an arc of vivid blood splashed across the wall. Dor flicked a lever on the side, blanking the screen, and she turned away. Here. The Marquis passed her a handkerchief. Thanks. She wiped her face, blew her nose vigorously, then she stared into space. Eventually, she said, Islington. I've never had any dealings with Islington, said the Marquis. I thought it was just a legend, she said. Not at all. He reached across the desk. Picked up the gold pocket watch, thumbed it open. Nice workmanship, he observed. She nodded. It was my father's. He closed the cover with a click. Time to go to market. It starts soon. Mr. Time is not our friend. She blew her nose once more, put her hands deep into the pockets of her leather jacket. Then she turned to him, elfin face frowning. Odd-coloured eyes bright. Do you honestly think we can find a bodyguard who could deal with Krupen Vandemar? The Marquis flashed his white teeth at her. There's been no one since Hunter who'd even be in there with a chance. No, I'll settle for someone who could give you the time you might need to get away. He fastened the fob of the watch chain to his waistcoat, slid the watch into his vest pocket.
What are you doing? Asked Dor.
That's my father's watch.
He's not using it anymore, is he?
He adjusted the golden chain.
There.
That looks rather elegant. He watched the emotions flicker across her face. Grief, anger, and, finally, resignation. We'd better go, was all she said.
The bridge isn't very far now, said Anesthesia.
Richard hoped that was true. They were now on the third candle. He was astonished that they were still under London. He was half convinced they had walked most of the way to Wales.
I'm really scared, she continued. I've never crossed the bridge before.
I thought you said you'd been to this market already, he asked, mystified.
It's the floating market, silly. I told you already. It moves. Different places. Last one I went to was held in that big clock tower, big someone. And the next was Big Ben.
Maybe. We were inside where all the big wheels went around, and that was where I got this. She held up her necklace. The candlelight glimmered yellow off the shiny quartz. She smiled, like a child.
Do you like it? She asked.
It's great. Was it expensive?
I swapped some stuff for it. That's how things work down here. We swap stuff.
And then they turned a corner and saw the bridge. It could have been one of the bridges over the Thames 500 years ago, thought Richard, a huge stone bridge spanning out over a vast black chasm into the night. But there was no sky above it, no water below. It rose into darkness. Richard wondered who built it and when. He wondered how something like this could exist beneath the city of London without everyone knowing. He felt a sinking feeling in the pit of his stomach. He was, he realized, deeply, pathetically scared of the bridge itself.
Do we have to go across it? He asked. Can't we get to the market some other way?
They paused at the base of the bridge. Anesthesia shook her head.
We can get to the place it's in, she said, but the market wouldn't be there.
Huh? Oh, that's ridiculous. I mean, something's either there or it's not.
Isn't it?
She shook her head. There was a buzz of voices from behind him, and someone pushed Richard to the ground. He looked up. A huge man, crudely tattooed, dressed in improvised rubber and leather clothes that looked like they had been cut out of the inside of cars, stared back down at him, dispassionately. Behind the huge man were a dozen others, male and female, people who looked like they were on their way to a particularly low-rent costume party.
Somebody, said Varney, who was not in a good mood, was in my way. Somebody ought to watch where he's going.
Once, as a small boy walking home from school, Richard had encountered a rat in a ditch by the side of the road. When the rat saw Richard, it had reared up onto its hind legs and hissed and jumped, terrifying Richard. He backed away, marveling that something so small had been so willing to fight something so much larger than itself. Now Anesthesia stepped between Richard and Varney. She was less than half his size, but she glared at the big man and bared her teeth, and she hissed like an angry rat at bay. Varney took a step backwards. Varney spat at Richard's shoes. Then he turned away, and taking the knot of people with him, he walked across the bridge and into the dark.
"Are you all right?"
asked Anesthesia, helping Richard back to his feet.
"I'm fine," he said. "That was really brave of you."
She looked down, shyly.
"I'm not really brave," she said. "I'm still scared of the bridge."
Even that lot was scared. That was why they all went over together. Safety in numbers. Big bullies.
If you are crossing the bridge, I will go with you, said a female voice, rich as cream and honey, coming from behind them. Richard was never able to place her accent. At the time, he thought she might be Canadian or American. Later, he suspected she might have been African or Australian or even Indian. He was never able to tell. She was a tall woman with long, tawny hair and skin the color of burnt caramel. She wore dappled leather clothes, mottled in shades of gray and brown. She had a battered leather duffel bag over her shoulder. She was carrying a staff and had a knife at her belt and an electric flashlight strapped to her wrist. She was, also, without question, the most beautiful woman that Richard had ever seen.
"Safety in numbers. You're welcome to come with us," he said, after a moment's hesitation. My name's Richard Mayhew. This is Anesthesia. She's the one of us who knows what she's doing." The rat girl preened. The leather woman looked him up and looked him down. "You're from London above," she told him.
"Yes."
"Travelling with a rat speaker. My word."
"I'm his guardian," said Anesthesia truculently. "Who are you? Who do you owe fealty to?"
The woman smiled.
"I owe no man fealty, rat girl."
"Have either of you crossed Knightsbridge before?" Anesthesia shook her head.
"Well," said the woman, "isn't this going to be fun?"
They walked toward the bridge. Anesthesia handed Richard her candle lamp.
"Here,"
she said.
"Thanks."
Richard looked at the woman in leather.
"Is there anything, really, to be scared of?"
"Only the night on the bridge," she said.
"The kind in armor."
"The kind that comes when day is over."
Anesthesia's hand sought Richard's. He held it tightly.
She smiled at him, squeezed his hand.
And then they set foot on Knight's Bridge, and Richard began to understand darkness. Darkness as something solid and real, so much more than a simple absence of light.
He felt it touch his skin, questing, moving, exploring, gliding through his mind. It slipped into his lungs, behind his eyes, into his mouth. With each step they took, the light of the candle became dimmer. He realized the same thing was happening to the leather woman's flashlight. It felt not so much as if the lights were being turned down, but as if the darkness were being turned up. Richard blinked and opened his eyes on nothing. Nothing but darkness, complete and utter.
Sounds.
A rustling, a squirming. Richard blinked, blinded by the night. The sounds were nastier, hungrier. Richard imagined he could hear voices, a horde of huge, misshapen trolls beneath the bridge. Something slithered past them in the dark.
"What's that?"
squeaked Anesthesia. Her hand was shaking in his.
"Hush," whispered the woman. "Don't attract its attention."
"What's happening?" whispered Richard.
"Darkness is happening," said the leather woman, very quietly. "Night is happening. All the nightmares that have come out when the sun goes down since the cave times, when we huddle together in fear for safety and for warmth, are happening. Now," she told them, "now is the time to be afraid of the dark."
Richard knew that something was about to creep over his face. He closed his eyes. It made no difference to what he saw or felt. The night was complete. It was then that the hallucination started.
He saw a figure falling toward him through the night, burning, its wings and hair on fire.
He threw up his hands. There was nothing there. Jessica looked at him with contempt in her eyes. He wanted to shout to her, tell her he was sorry. Place one foot after another. He was a small child, walking home from school at night down the one road with no streetlights. No matter how many times he did it, it never got any easier, never got any better. He was deep in the sewers, lost in a labyrinth. The beast was waiting for him. He could hear a slow drip of water. He knew the beast was waiting. He gripped his spear. Then a rumbling bellow deep in its throat from behind him. He turned. Slowly, agonizingly slowly, it charged at him through the dark. And it charged. He died. And kept walking. Slowly, agonizingly slowly, it charged at him over and over through the dark. There was a sputter and a flare so bright it hurt, making Richard squint and stagger. It was the candle flame in its lemonade bottle holder. He had never known how brightly a single candle could burn. He held it up, gasping and gulping and shaking with relief. His heart was pounding and shuddering in his chest. "We would appear to have crossed successfully," said the leather woman. Richard's heart was pounding in his chest so hard that, for a few moments, he was unable to talk. He forced himself to breathe slowly to calm down. They were in a large anteroom, exactly like the one on the other side. In fact, Richard had the strange feeling that it was the same room they had just left. Yet the shadows were deeper, and there were after-images floating before Richard's eyes like those one saw after a camera flash. "I suppose," Richard said haltingly, "we weren't in any real danger. It was like a haunted house, a few noises in the dark, and your imagination does the rest. There wasn't anything to be scared of, was there?" The woman looked at him, almost pityingly, and Richard realized that there was nobody holding his hand. "Anesthesia?" From the darkness at the crown of the bridge came a gentle noise, like a rustle or a sigh. A handful of irregular quartz beads pattered down the curve of the bridge toward them. Richard picked one up. It was from the rat girl's necklace. "Are we better? We have to go back. She's..." The woman raised her flashlight, shone it across the bridge. Richard could see all the way across the bridge. It was deserted. "Where is she?" he asked. "Gone," said the woman, flatly. The darkness took her. "We've got to do something," said Richard, urgently.
"Such as?"
He opened his mouth, but this time he found no words. He closed it again. He fingered the lump of quartz, looked at the others on the ground.
"She's gone," said the woman. "The bridge takes its toll. Be grateful it didn't take you, too. Now, if you're going to the market, it's through here. Up this way." She gestured toward a narrow passageway that rose up into the dimness in front of them, barely illuminated by the beam of her flashlight. Richard did not move. He felt numb. He found it hard to believe that the rat girl was gone, lost or stolen or strayed or... And harder to believe that the leather woman was able to carry on as if nothing at all out of the ordinary had happened, as if this were utterly usual. Anesthesia could not be dead. He completed the thought. She could not be dead, because if she were, then it was his fault. She had not asked to go with him. He held the quartz bead so tightly it hurt his hand, thinking of the pride with which she had shown it to him, of how fond he had become of her in the handful of hours that he had known her. "Are you coming?" Richard stood there in the darkness for a few pounding heartbeats. Then he placed the quartz bead gently into the pocket of his jeans. He followed the woman, who was still some paces ahead of him. As he followed her, he realized that he still did not know her name. Chapter 5. People slipped and slid through the darkness about them, holding lamps and torches, flashlights and candles. It made Richard think of documentary films he'd seen of schools of fish glittering and darting through the ocean. Deep water, inhabited by things that had lost the use of their eyes. Richard followed the leather woman up some steps. Stone steps, edged with metal. They were in an underground station. They joined a line of people waiting to slip through a grill, which had been opened a foot or so to uncover the door, which led out onto the pavement. Immediately in front of them were a couple of young boys, each with a string tied around his wrist. The strings were held by a pallid, bald man who smelled of formaldehyde. Immediately behind them in the line waited a grey-bearded man with a black-and-white kitten sitting on his shoulder. It washed itself intently, licked the man's ear, then curled up on his shoulder and went to sleep. The line moved slowly as, one by one, the figures at the end slipped through the space between the grill and the wall and edged into the night. "Why are you going to the market, Richard Mayhew?" asked the leather woman, in a low voice. "I have friends I'm hoping to meet there. Well, just one friend, actually. I don't actually know many people from this world. I was sort of getting to know Anesthesia, but..." He trailed off, asked the question he had not dared to voice until this moment. "Is she dead?" The woman shrugged. "Yes, or as good as. I trust your visit to the market will make her loss worthwhile." Richard shivered. "I don't think it could," he said. They were approaching the front of the queue. "What do you do?" he asked. She smiled. "I sell personal physical services." "Oh," he said. Then, "what kind of personal physical services?" "I rent my body." She did not elaborate. "Ah." He was too weary to pursue it, to press her to explain just what she meant. He had an idea, though. And then they stepped out into the night. Richard looked back. The sign on the station said, "Knightsbridge." He didn't know whether to smile or to mourn. It felt like the small hours of the morning. Richard looked down at his watch and was not surprised to notice that the digital face was now completely blank. Perhaps the batteries had died, or, he thought, more likely, time in London below had only a passing acquaintance with the kind of time he was used to. He did not care. He unstrapped the watch and dropped it into the nearest waste bin. The odd people were crossing the road in a stream, walking through the double doors facing them. "There," he said, appalled. The woman nodded. "There." The building was large and covered with many thousands of burning lights. Conspicuous coats of arms on the wall facing them proclaimed that it proudly sold all sorts of things by appointment to various members of the British royal family. Richard, who had spent many a footsore weekend hour trailing behind Jessica through every prominent shop in London, recognized it immediately, even without the huge sign proclaiming it to be Harrods. The woman nodded. "Only for tonight," she said. "The next market could be anywhere." "But I mean," said Richard, "Harrods." It seemed almost sacrilegious to be sneaking into this place at night. They walked in through the side door. The room was dark. They passed the bureau de change and the gift-wrapping section, through another darkened room selling sunglasses and figurines, and then they stepped into the Egyptian room. Color and light broke over Richard like a wave hitting the shore. His companion turned to him. She yawned, cat-like, shading the vivid pinkness of her mouth with the back of her caramel hand. And then she smiled and said, "Well, you're here, safe and more or less sound. I have business to attend to. Fare you well." She nodded curtly and slipped away into the crowd. Richard stood there, alone in the throng, drinking it in. It was pure madness. Of that there was no doubt at all. It was loud and brash and insane, and it was, in many ways, quite wonderful. People argued, haggled, shouted, sang. They hawked and touted their wares and loudly declaimed the superiority of their merchandise. Music was playing, a dozen different kinds of music being played a dozen different ways on a score of different instruments, most of them improvised, improved, improbable. Richard could smell food. All kinds of food. The smells of curries and spices seemed to predominate, with beneath them the smells of grilling meats and mushrooms. Stalls had been set up all through the shop, next to or even on counters that, during the day, had sold perfume or watches or amber or silk scarves. Everybody was buying. Everybody was selling. Richard listened to the market cries as he began to wander through the crowds.
"Lovely fresh dreams, first-class nightmares, we got 'em, get your lovely nightmares here. Weapons, arm yourself, defend your cellar, cave or hole. You want to hit 'em, we got 'em, come on, darling, come on over here." "Rubbish!" screamed a fat, elderly woman in Richard's ear as he passed her malodorous stall. "Junk," she continued, "garbage, trash, offal, debris, come and get it, nothing whole or undamaged, crap, tripe and useless piles of shit, you know you want it."
A man in armour beat a small drum and chanted as he did so,
"Lost property, roll up and see for yourself, lost property, none of your found muck here, everything guaranteed properly lost."
Richard wandered through the huge rooms of the store, like a man in a trance. He was unable even to guess how many people there were at the night market. 1,000? 2,000? 5,000? One stall was piled high with bottles, full bottles and empty bottles of every shape and every size, from bottles of booze to one huge glimmering bottle that could have contained nothing but a captive gin. Another sold lamps and candles made of many kinds of wax and tallow. A man thrust what appeared to be a child's severed hand, clutching a candle towards him as he passed, muttering, "End of glory, sir? Send him up the wooden hill to Bedfordshire, guaranteed to work." Richard hurried past, not wishing to find out what a hand of glory was, nor how it worked. He passed a stall selling glittering gold and silver jewellery, another selling jewellery made from what looked like the valves and wires of antique radios. There were stalls that sold every manner of book and magazine, others that sold clothes, old clothes, patched and mended and made strange. Several tattooists, something that he was almost certain was a small slave market. He kept well clear of this. A dentist's chair with a foot-operated manual drill with a line of miserable people standing beside it waiting to have their teeth pulled or filled, by a young man who seemed to be having altogether too good a time. A bent old man selling unlikely things that might have been hats and might have been examples of modern art. Something that looked very much like a portable shower facility. Even a blacksmith's. And every few stalls, there would be somebody selling food. Some of them had food cooking over open fires, curries and potatoes and chestnuts and huge mushrooms and exotic breads. Richard found himself wondering why the smoke from the fires didn't set off the building's sprinkler system. Then he found himself wondering why no one was looting the store. Why set up their own little stalls? Why not just take things from the shop itself? He knew better at this point than to risk asking anyone. He seemed marked as a man from London above, and thus worthy of great suspicion. There was something deeply tribal about the people, Richard decided. He tried to pick out distinct groups,
There were the ones who looked like they had escaped from a historical reenactment society. The ones who reminded him of hippies. The albino people in grey clothes and dark glasses. The polished, dangerous ones in smart suits and black gloves. The huge, almost identical women who walked together in twos and threes and nodded when they saw each other. The tangle-haired ones who looked like they probably lived in sewers and who smelled like hell. And 100 other types and kinds. He wondered how normal London, his London, would look to an alien. And that made him bold. He began to ask them as he went, "Excuse me, I'm looking for a man named De Carabas and a girl called Dor. Do you know where I'd find them?" People shook their heads, apologized, averted their eyes, moved away. Richard took a step back and stepped on someone's foot. Someone was well over 7 feet tall and was covered in tufty ginger hair. Someone's teeth had been sharpened to points. Someone picked Richard up with a hand the size of a sheep's head and put Richard's head so close to someone's mouth that Richard almost gagged. "I'm really sorry," said Richard. I'm looking for a girl named Dor, do you know?" But someone dropped him onto the floor and moved on. Another whiff of cooking food wafted across the floor, and Richard, who had managed to forget how hungry he was ever since he had declined the prime cut of roast cat he could not think how many hours before, now found his mouth watering and his thinking processes beginning to grind to a halt. The iron-haired woman, running the next food stall he came to, did not reach to Richard's waist. When Richard tried to talk to her, she shook her head, drew a finger across her lips. She could not talk. Or did not talk, or did not want to talk. Richard found himself conducting the negotiations for a cottage cheese and lettuce sandwich and a cup of what looked and smelled like a form of home-brewed lemonade in dumb show. His food cost him a ballpoint pen and a book of matches he had forgotten he had. The little woman must have felt that she had got by far the better of the deal, for as he took his food, she threw in a couple of small, nutty biscuits. Richard stood in the middle of the throng, listening to the music. Someone was, for no reason that Richard could easily discern, singing the lyrics of Greensleeves to the tune of Yakety Yak, watching the bizarre bazaar unfold around him, and eating his sandwiches. He realized, as he finished the last of the sandwiches, that he had no idea how anything he had just eaten had tasted, and he resolved to slow down and chew the biscuits more slowly. He sipped the lemonade, making it last.
"You need a bird, sir?"
asked a cheery voice close at hand.
"I got rooks and ravens, crows and starlings, fine, wise birds, tasty and wise. Brilliant!"
Richard said, "No, thank you," and turned around. The hand-painted sign above the stall said, "Old Bailey's Birds and Information." There were other, smaller signs scattered about. "You wants it, we knows it." And, "You won't find a plumper starling." And, "When it's time for a rook, it's time for Old Bailey." Richard found himself reminded of the man he had seen when he'd first come to London. He used to stand outside Leicester Square tube station with a huge hand-painted sandwich board which exhorted the world to less lust through less protein, eggs, meat, beans, cheese, and sitting. Birds hopped and fluttered about small cages that looked like they had been woven out of television aerials.
"Information, then," continued Old Bailey, warming to his sales pitch. "Roof maps, history, secret and mysterious knowledge. If I don't knows it, it's probably better forgot. That's what I says."
The old man still wore his feathered coat, was still wrapped about with ropes and cords. He blinked at Richard, then pulled on the pair of spectacles tied about his neck with string, and inspected Richard carefully through them.
"Hang on, I knows you. You was with the Marquis de Carabas.
on the rooftops. Remember, hey, I'm Old Bailey. Remember me?
He thrust out his hand, pumped Richard's hand furiously.
I actually, said Richard, I'm looking for the Marquis and for a young lady named Dor. I think they're probably together.
The old man did a little jig, causing several feathers to detach themselves from his coat and provoking a chorus of raucous disapproval from the various birds around them.
Information! Information! He announced to the crowded room. See? I told them. Diversify, I said. Diversify! You can't sell rooks for the stew pot forever. Anyway, they taste like boiled slipper. And they're so stupid! Thick as custard! You ever eaten rook?
Richard shook his head. That was something he could be certain of, at any rate.
What'll you give me?
Asked Old Bailey.
Sorry?
Said Richard, awkwardly leaping from ice floe to ice floe in the stream of the old man's consciousness.
If and I'll give ye your information, what'll I get?
I don't have any money, said Richard, and I just gave my pen away. He began to pull out the contents of his pockets.
There, said Old Bailey. That.
My hanky, asked Richard.
It was not a particularly clean handkerchief. It had been a present from his Aunt Maud on his last birthday. Old Bailey seized it and waved it above his head happily.
Never you fear, laddie, he sang triumphantly. Your quest is at an end. Go down there, through that door. You can't miss them. They're auditioning.
He was pointing towards Harrod's extensive network of food halls. A rook cawed maliciously.
None of your beak, said Old Bailey to the rook.
And to Richard he said, Thank'ee for the little flag. He jigged around his stall, delighted, waving Richard's handkerchief to and fro.
Auditioning, thought Richard.
And then he smiled. It didn't matter. His quest, as the mad old roofman had put it, was at an end. He walked toward the food halls.
Fashion in Bodyguards seemed to be everything. They all had a knack of one kind or another, and each of them was desperate to demonstrate it to the world. At this moment, Ryslip was facing off against the fop with no name. The fop with no name looked somewhat like an early 18th century rake, one who hadn't been able to find real rake clothes, and had had to make do with what he could find at the Salvation Army store. His face was powdered to white, his lips painted red. Ryslip, the fop's opponent, looked like the kind of dream one might have if one fell asleep watching sumo wrestling on the television with a Bob Marley record playing in the background. He was a huge Rastafarian who looked like nothing so much as an obese and enormous baby. They were standing face to face in the middle of a cleared circle of spectators and other bodyguards and sightseers. Neither man moved a muscle. The fop was a good head taller than Ryslip. On the other hand, Ryslip weighed as much as four fops, each of them carrying a large leather suitcase entirely filled with lard. They stared at each other without breaking eye contact. The Marquis de Carabas tapped Dor on the shoulder and pointed. Something was about to happen. One moment, there were two men standing impassively, just looking at each other. Then the fop's head rocked back as if he'd just been hit in the face. A small reddish-purple bruise appeared on his cheek. He pursed his lips and fluttered his eyelashes.
La,
he said, then stretched his rouged lips wide in a ghastly parody of a smile. The fop gestured. Ryslip staggered and clutched his stomach. The fop with no name smirked outrageously, waggled his fingers, and blew kisses to several spectators. Ryslip stared angrily at the fop, redoubling his mental assault. Blood began to drip from the fop's lips. His left eye started to swell. He staggered. The audience muttered appreciatively.
"It's not as impressive as it looks," whispered the Marquis to Dor.
The fop with no name stumbled suddenly, going onto his knees as if someone were forcing him down, and he fell awkwardly to the floor. Then he jerked, as if someone had just kicked him hard in the stomach.
Ryslip looked triumphant.
The spectators clapped politely. The fop writhed and spat blood onto the sawdust of the floor of Harrod's Fish and Meat Hall. He was dragged off into the corner by some friends and was violently sick.
"Next," said the Marquis.
The next would-be bodyguard was again thinner than Ryslip, being about the size of 2½ fops, carrying but a single suitcase filled with lard between them. He was covered in tattoos and dressed in clothes that looked like they had been stitched together from old car seats and rubber mats. He was shaven-headed, and he sneered at the world through rotten teeth.
"I'm Varney,"
he said, and he hawked and spat green on the sawdust. He walked into the ring.
"When you're ready, gentlemen," said the Marquis.
Ryslip stamped his bare feet on the floor, sumo-like, 1-2, 1-2, and commenced to stare, hard, at Varney. A small cut opened on Varney's forehead, and blood began to drip from it into one eye. Varney ignored it, and instead appeared to be concentrating on his right arm. He pulled his arm up slowly, like a man fighting a great deal of pressure. Then he slammed his fist into Ryslip's nose, which began to spurt blood. Ryslip drew one long, horrible breath and hit the ground with the sound of half a ton of wet liver being dropped into a bathtub. Varney giggled. Ryslip slowly pulled himself back to his feet, blood from his nose soaking his mouth and chest, dripping onto the sawdust. Varney wiped the blood from his forehead and bared his ruined mouth at the world in an appalling grin.
"Come on," he said. "Fat wanker, hit me again."
"That one's promising," muttered the Marquis.
Dor raised an eyebrow. "He doesn't look very nice."
"Nice in a bodyguard," lectured the Marquis, "is about as useful as the ability to regurgitate whole lobsters. He looks dangerous."
There was a murmur of appreciation, then, as Varney did something rather fast and painful to Ryslip, something that involved the sudden connection of Varney's leather-bound knee and Ryslip's testicles. The murmur was the kind of restrained and deeply unenthusiastic applause one normally only hears in England on sleepy, sunny Sunday afternoons at village cricket matches. The Marquis clapped politely with the rest of them.
"Very good, sir," he said.
Varney looked at Dor, and he winked at her, almost proprietorially, before he returned his attention to Ryslip. Dor shivered. Richard heard the clapping and walked toward it. Five almost identically dressed, extremely pale young women walked past him. They wore long dresses made of velvet, each dress so dark it was almost black, respectively dark green, dark chocolate, royal blue, dark blood, pure black. Each woman had black hair and wore silver jewelry. Each was perfectly coiffed, perfectly made up. They moved silently. Richard was aware only of a swish of heavy velvet as they went past, a swish that sounded almost like a sigh. The last of the women, the one dressed all in utter black, the palest and the most beautiful, smiled at Richard. He smiled back at her, warily. Then he walked on toward the audition. It was being held in the Fish and Meat Hall, on the open area of floor beneath Harrod's fish sculpture. The audience, had their back to him, were standing two or three people deep. Richard wondered if he would easily be able to find Dor and the Marquis.
And then the crowd parted, and he saw them both sitting on the glass top of the smoked salmon counter. He opened his mouth to shout, "Door!" And as he did so, he realized why the crowd had parted, as an enormous dreadlocked man, naked but for a green, yellow and red cloth wrapped like a diaper about his midriff, came catapulting through the crowd as if tossed by a giant, and landed squarely on top of him. "Richard?" she said. He opened his eyes. The face swam in and out to focus. Fire opal-coloured eyes peering into his from a pale elfin face. "Door?" he said. She looked furious. She looked beyond fury. "Temple and arch, Richard. I don't believe it. What are you doing here?" "It's nice to see you too," said Richard, weakly. He sat up and wondered if he was suffering from a concussion. He wondered how he'd know if he was, and he wondered why he had ever thought that Dor would have been pleased to see him. She stared intently at her nails, nostrils flaring as if she did not trust herself to say anything else. The big man with the very bad teeth, who had knocked Richard over on the bridge, was fighting with a dwarf. They were fighting with crowbars, and the fight was not as unequal as one might have imagined. The dwarf was preternaturally fast. He rolled, he struck, he bounced, he dove. His every movement made Varney appear lumbering and awkward by comparison. Richard turned to the Marquis, who was watching the fight intently. "What's happening?" he asked. The Marquis spared him a glance, and then returned his gaze to the action in front of them. "You," he said, "are out of your depth, in deep shit, and I would imagine a few hours away from an untimely and undoubtedly messy end. We, on the other hand, are auditioning bodyguards." Varney connected his crowbar with the dwarf, who instantly stopped bouncing and darting, and instantly began lying insensible. "I think we've seen enough," said the Marquis loudly. "Thank you all, Mr. Varney, if you could wait behind." "Why did you have to come here?" Dor said to Richard, frostily. "I didn't really have much choice," said Richard. She sighed. The Marquis was walking around the perimeter, dismissing the various bodyguards who had already auditioned, distributing a few words of praise here, of advice there. Varney waited patiently off to one side. Richard essayed a smile at Dor. It was ignored. "How did you get to the market?" she asked. "There are these rat people," Richard began. "Rat speakers?" she said. "And you see, the rat who brought us the Marquis's message..." "Master Longtail?" she said. "Well, he told them they had to get me here." She raised an eyebrow, cocked her head slightly on one side. "A rat speaker brought you here?" He nodded. "Most of the way. Her name was Anesthesia. She, well, something happened to her on the bridge. This other lady brought me the rest of the way here. I think she was a, you know..." He hesitated, then said it. "Hooker." The Marquis had returned. He stood in front of Varney, who looked obscenely pleased with himself. "A weapons expertise?" asked the Marquis. "Phew," said Varney. "Put it like this. If you can cut someone with it, blow someone's head off with it, break a bone with it, or make a nasty hole in someone with it, then Varney's the master of it."
Previous satisfied employers include?
Olympia, the Shepherd Queen, the Crouch Enders. I've done security for the Mayfair for a bit as well.
Well, said the Marquis de Carabas, we're all very impressed with your skill.
I had heard, said a female voice, that you had put out a call for bodyguards, not for enthusiastic amateurs.
Her skin was the colour of burnt caramel,
and her smile would have stopped a revolution. She was dressed entirely in soft, mottled grey and brown leathers, and Richard recognised her immediately.
"That's her,"
Richard whispered to Dor.
"The hooker."
"Varney," said Varney, affronted. "He's the best guard and bravo in the underside. Everyone knows that."
The woman looked at the Marquis. "You've finished the trials?" she asked.
"Yes," said Varney.
"Not necessarily," said the Marquis. "Then," she told him, "I would like to audition." There was a beat before the Marquis de Carabas said, "Very well," and stepped backwards, leapt up to the smoked salmon counter and sat, comfortably watching the action. Varney was undoubtedly dangerous, not to mention a bully, a sadist, and actively harmful to the physical health of those around him. What he was not, though, was particularly quick on the uptake. He stared at the Marquis as the penny dropped and dropped and kept on dropping. Finally, in disbelief, he asked,
"I have to fight her?"
"Yes," said the leather woman. "Unless you'd like a little lie down first?" Varney began to laugh, a manic giggle. He stopped laughing a moment later when the woman kicked him hard in the solar plexus, and he toppled like a tree. Near his hand, on the floor, was the crowbar he had used in the fight with the dwarf. He grabbed it, slammed it into the woman's face, or would have, had she not ducked out of the way. She clapped her open hands onto his ears very fast. The crowbar went flying across the room. Still reeling from the pain in his ears, Varney pulled a knife from his boot. He was not entirely sure what happened after that, only that the world swung out from under him, and then he was lying face down on the ground with blood coming from his ears and his own knife at his throat, while the Marquis de Carabas was saying,
"Enough!"
The woman looked up, still holding Varney's knife to his throat. "Well?" she said.
"Very impressive," said the Marquis.
Dor nodded.
Richard was thunderstruck.
It had been like watching Emma Peel, Bruce Lee, and a particularly vicious tornado, all rolled into one and sprinkled with a generous helping of footage he had once seen on a wildlife program of a mongoose killing a king cobra. That was how she had moved. That was how she had fought. Richard normally found displays of real violence unnerving, but he found watching this woman in action exhilarating, as if she were finding a part of him he had not known existed. It seemed utterly right, in this unreal mirror of the London he had known, that she should be here, and that she should be fighting so dangerously and so well. She was part of London below. He understood that now. And as he thought that, he thought about London above, and a world in which no one fought like this, no one needed to fight like this. A world of safety and sanity, and for a moment the homesickness engulfed him like a fever. The woman looked down at Varney.
"Thank you, Mr. Varney," she said politely. "I'm afraid we won't be needing your services after all."
She got off him and put his knife away in her belt.
"And you are called?" asked the Marquis.
"I'm called Hunter," she said.
Nobody said anything. Then Dor said hesitantly,
"The Hunter?"
"That's right," said Hunter, and she brushed the dust of the floor from her leather leggings. "I'm back." From somewhere a bell sounded. Twice, a deep bonging noise that made Richard's teeth vibrate.
5 minutes, muttered the Marquis.
Then he said to the remains of the crowd,
"I think we found our bodyguard. Thank you all very much. Nothing more to see."
Hunter walked over to Dor and looked her up and down.
"Can you stop people killing me?"
asked Dor. Hunter inclined her head toward Richard. I saved his life 3 times today, crossing the bridge, coming to the market,